Hi, everyone. Good morning. Oh, the crossover day and last day of South by Southwest EDU. It's really nice to meet all of you, and I appreciate you coming to this session. So my name is Anne-Marie Baines, and I'm the founder and executive director of a nonprofit in the San Francisco Bay Area called The Practice Space, which elevates systemically marginalized voices through public speaking education with the effort to be able to help people feel confident with their voice. I used to be terrified of debate, and it's hard to believe that it's been 23 years since I started coaching it. I grew up in a small family in a small house that was very, very loud. We were arguing all the time, whether it was about the TV or dishes or life. And whenever anything didn't work, like dial-up in the 90s, frustration would just escalate into shouting and screaming. My dad was bipolar, and it wasn't always easy. We all loved each other, but sometimes the only way to be heard was through volume. School was a totally different story. At school, being a good student meant following the rules. It meant being good and being quiet, especially if you were a girl. And growing up Filipino-American and growing up in the church, I always followed my mom's rules. Always smile, be nice to your teachers, and make friends. And only speak when it's your turn, and when it's your turn, always raise your hand. Loud at home and quiet at school, that's just the way it was. And it wasn't until I entered high school and middle school that I could just feel my opinions just bottled up inside. Speaking up was so scary, because at home it meant tears, and at school it meant trouble. It was only until I joined the speech and debate team at the urging of one of my best friends that I could see that I could have a different identity. Every weekend, I saw what it looked like to use your voice to capture people's attention. I saw what it looked like to be able to put your opinions out there, and the more that I did it, the easier it became. And with that confidence came the ability to be able to put myself out there. I'm here today to talk to you about why we can't be afraid to argue, and why debate is so scary, but we have to be able to get through it in order to heal. Sometimes debate's not the best format to be able to explore any topic, because sometimes you need to tell a story, or you need to write a poem, or sometimes you need to, you know, be able to have a discussion. But debate has the potential to heal rifts and help you seek clarity and understanding. And we can't be afraid to argue if we're going to heal. So let's talk a little bit about healing for a moment. So there's so much wonderful work in this area led by really important Black scholars, feminists, and activists. Prentice Hemphill and their work on embodied learning and healing through societal trauma. Adrienne Marie Brown and her work on healing through self-love and pleasure. Trisha Hershey and her pioneering work on the importance of rest in the context of social justice education. Harvard professor Sean Ginwright and his work on also the importance of rest, but being able to use rest to reflect and reconcile your own inner journey with what's going on the outside. Storytelling, advocacy, and poetry are such wonderful, wonderful vehicles for expressing this journey. And it helps to have rest, to be able to have that inner reflection and figure out really what you want to say and how you want to say it. So we need more narrative, creative, and persuasive formats of public speaking in the classroom so that students can be able to let their identities go. Storytelling has the power to heal. But debate? When I was a student, when I first heard about debate, the first thing that came to mind were shouting matches, speaking off the top of your head, and losing in a really public way. No, thank you. Debate is scary. And one of the things that happens with debate is that when it's done well, you're talking about something really important to you, and at its very best, you're putting your identity at risk. And at its worst, you don't even have facilitators. So you're putting yourself out there and potentially being labeled in a way that you don't want to be. Or sometimes you risk damaging relationships. It's so easy to feel like an imposter with debate because when you don't feel qualified, you don't want to speak. So now that I've sold you on the importance of debate, let's talk about a different vision. So Bob Lighton from the Brookings Institution defines debate in a different way. He talks about the importance of structured civil discussion, two sides to an issue, focusing on substance, featuring time limits for each side, to persuade an audience to make informed choices, incorporate new information, and identify ways to reach consensus. Good debate actually requires a lot of listening. It requires you to have critical literacy and to critique history, and actually equips people with the power to make informed choices, which is especially important when voting and strengthening democracy. He says, learning by individuals and organizations can't happen unless people are open to understanding and incorporating new information, facts, and theories, and if appropriate, doing things differently, often changing their minds in the process. Bob Lighton doesn't really talk about self-healing in the context of debate work. And he is, after all, a white economist. And his work is really focused on healing of America by being able to heal rifts and encourage more participation in democracy. So it's not as aligned with some of the earlier research that I just mentioned. However, what he does mention is that debate is a really important learning tool to be able to restore open dialogue and be able to help people think critically across division. And so by that token and by that definition, debate is a really important tool if we want to be able to repair our damaged histories. Sean Ginwright then goes on to say that healing is the capacity to restore our humanity and care for ourselves and others, even in the midst of our fears. Healing is the only pathway to real justice because it requires that we take an honest look at what harmed us and pushes us to restore our humanity and finally move confidently into a possible future. So let's take the analogy of healing from a physical injury. Sometimes the most important thing you can do is rest. But other times, you actually need to build muscle and address imbalances. And so sometimes you actually need to practice hard things so that your body is ready. So by that same definition, debate allows students to be able to practice tackling hard and harmful things. Debate offers that safe place to be able to practice that skill of articulating your own perspective, but also listening to others. Avoiding debate because we're afraid to disagree actually puts students at a disadvantage because it teaches them to choose silence over dialogue. So I first learned debate in a large urban high school in California. And at the time, it was the only public school in California that offered a competitive debate program. We received no funding from the district, and it was actually led by really dedicated volunteer teachers. I remember still to this day walking into the debate class for the first time, and I was shocked by how peaceful it was. It was led by a chemistry teacher, but it was about philosophy. And when we walked in there, we discussed individual versus collective rights. We discussed activism and social justice. We talked about human nature as a whole. From Cornel West to Foucault to Kant and Marx, we use philosophy to really explore the foundation of all our arguments. We learned how to clarify definitions. We learned how to clarify that throughout a round, how to structure arguments, and how to structure the round itself. And as a really quiet student who was really afraid and was forced into debate, it was really soothing to know that there was a way that I could actually have access to this activity and also a group of people who would still love me and support me, even if I disagreed. So one of the things that I want to talk about is at tournaments, it was always something that was a real test to my strength. So at tournaments, I was often the only Filipino student there, even in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I was one of only two girls in the top 15 debaters on the national circuit. And one time, a judge, an adult judge, actually told me in all seriousness, "You are too aggressive for a girl." And I remember that experience to this day. And it's weird to think about that experience as a healing one, but it was. Because at 16 years old, I learned that I could be thrust into hard situations and still hold on to my power. I learned that I could speak up, but also when to let go. I learned how to take that complex thinking from a speech and debate round and apply it to my internal thinking, trying to wrestle with complexity and trying to understand my own mixed race identity and the experience of being underrepresented and unheard. So in his book, The Four Pivots, Sean Jin Wright mentions that we actually need to be able to cultivate our capacity to see humanity in people who are not like us. And in order to do this, we have to pivot from a mindset of problem fixing to possibility creating. In order to do that, we have to be able to build our capacity to see people, despite the fact that we might disagree with them. In the long road to healing our divisions, it's so important to move away from zero-sum thinking, where it's us versus them, where we just label people and write them off and don't try to actually understand their perspectives. It can be really tempting to do that, but one thing that Sean Jin Wright mentions is that that actually comes at a psychic cost, because healing requires us to have perspective and to understand them in the world. Gaining perspective, he says, is not a matter of being right or wrong, but rather it just means that we pull back and become curious about a bigger picture. One of the ways that you can do that in a debate round, how many teachers are in this audience here, I'm curious? Yay, excellent. And all of us, I think, are educators at heart. So one of the things that's really important with gaining perspective in debate is starting with how you word the topic. So a topic should be worded in a way that helps broaden perspective, but also narrows down the issue that you want to tackle in that moment. Topic should be worded as a sentence, not a question, a sentence. A question is for discussions. So as a sentence, you have one side that supports the sentence as written, and the other side offers an alternative to that sentence. Now, another thing to really avoid is undebatable topics, where sometimes the topics are imbalance. You have different sides that just one has an advantage over the other. Or you're asking one person to defend a viewpoint that goes fundamentally against their identities, their beliefs, and their identities. And when that happens, you don't want to have a situation where you're asking, for example, a black student to defend slavery as an intellectual exercise. And that's not okay. What debate needs to do instead is inspire a productive conversation. So one of the two most important questions you can ask yourself is, what is the core issue that you want your class to explore? And is this going to be a productive debate? I'm no stranger to unproductive debates. Even just a month ago, I made the mistake of having the debate, third graders are better than fourth graders, with some of our young speakers at the practice space, and it totally dissolved into tears because it was so personal, and I will never make that mistake again. What I should have done instead was have the topic resolved, age is important, because that would have allowed us to take a step back and explore the nuance. So I didn't make that mistake when one of our teens wanted to argue Cristiano Ronaldo is better than Lionel Messi. Instead, I stopped and I reframed the debate as sports teams with superstar celebrity players are better than those without them. So again, we could take a step back. We had those same arguments, but we could actually even begin to have a conversation. And I loved being able to instill that habit of seeking clarity of language by asking students to define the terms in debate, which is something that I always do. So that definitions are always really important in debate, but in life, that kind of formality is sometimes really hard. When you feel a debate coming in a regular conversation, especially in this day and age, it can be good to just stop and say, I want to take a pause. Wait, before we continue, I just want to check that we're arguing about X, and that by X we mean... So checking for understanding can help us have a better conversation. Sometimes even delaying that conversation can be a good thing. Exploring hypothetical situations where you actually say, so let's say... It gives you some distance from the deeply personal issues. And so by doing that, we can actually have that conversation and... You know, hopefully have a chance to be able to clarify definitions in life. Because how often have you been in a situation where you were arguing about one thing and it was actually about another thing? So in healing-centered work, when we connect healing and debate, Sean Jin Wright argues and asks, how do we cultivate an outlook that allows us to listen to each other without judgment and try to see our mutual humanity across difference? It's one thing to talk about age is important and sports players, but when we get down to the core of the issue, talking with people that you don't agree with is really, really hard. And so one thing he tells us is that we have to build up our capacity to temporarily be able to take what he calls a third position. So in his book, which I highly recommend, he has three positions he talks about. The first position is where you articulate a clear point of view that you really believe in. The second position is also a point of view that you believe in, and it goes against the other side. That's basically what debate is. The third position is our capacity to observe, listen, and understand, and be what he calls an observer of issues without abandoning our views and emotions. We don't want to actually, like, we don't want to abandon those. We still have them, but we temporarily are able to take a step back and observe. And when we look at this kind of work, in our work at the practice space, we spend a lot of time just on the first position, helping people articulate what they think and their point of view. So our work at the practice space is really talking about the connections between literacy, agency, and voice. And we believe that public speaking is a lever for equity and a gateway to liberation and leadership. So we help people, we design curriculum, we help lead programs for people of all ages in and out of school and in workplaces so that they can build up this confidence. And we also help teachers by leading professional development so that they have the capacity to create brave and safe spaces for students to learn. And we pay our teens to be able to mentor our younger students. And it's really exciting because over the last 7 years, we've served 2,800 participants. And across all of those ages and those 2,800 participants, the first position is where we end up having to spend a lot of our time, let alone the third position, which is really hard and abstract. So the first position, when we're teaching this, it's really important to be able to do this in the classroom. What I'm talking about is the structure of an argument: claim, warrant, and impact. How many people are familiar with claim, evidence, and reasoning? Yeah, so it's a lot like that. But in debate, we have claim is an opinion statement. Warrant are the examples and evidence and reasoning, all bundled together to support that argument. And an impact is that added piece. That's when you're saying why your argument matters and what it leads to. It's the therefore. So I love dogs, so a hypothetical example might be, I believe that dogs make wonderful companions. That's the claim. The warrant is, I believe this is true because there are many historical examples where dogs have provided important companionship and care and protection. That's the warrant. The impact would be that protection and care make human beings happier overall and lead longer lives. I definitely believe in that one. So when we're in the classroom, it helps to build that muscle through warm-ups and skills. So I do a really quick one. It only takes less than 5 minutes. And that's where I have people start off by saying a claim, just any kind of opinion statement. And then the next person says, yes, and, to support it. And then all the people after that each have to say, and that leads to, and that leads to, and that leads to. So if I started off with the claim, gorillas make great pets. Anyone have a yes and? Yay, they're snuggly and warm. What does snuggly and warm lead to? Cuddles, that leads to cuddles. What do cuddles lead to? Happiness, excellent. And you can keep going and keep going, keep going. That's often an exercise we call blowing up the balloon. It can go like super, super far and sometimes gets ridiculous, but it's fun. So that's the first position, and the second position is basically the same thing, it's just another side. So once you set up the rules of a debate and what that looks like, you have to set up the rules of engagement, and so that's basically the structure. So a structure of any kind of debate, there are many formats. In competition, there's actually, I think, 8 different formats by now, but all of them have opening speeches, questions, responses with some kind of signposting, and a set of summary. And I like to teach students to signpost, which means that they say which arguments they're going to argue against. So they might say, I say this, they say that, I would say this back. And so they're kind of like helping you along the way, which helps improve organization. It also helps the listener. And speaking of listening, it can be really important in order to help people achieve that third position and observe without judgment to actually ironically teach them how to judge. So that's where I teach really rigorous note-taking. In debate, there's a style of note-taking called flowing, which is where you actually write all of your notes about one speech in a column, and then you line up all of the responses next to each corresponding argument, and then you line the next one up and the next one up, so you can see the flow of a debate. And so I do this first for students on the board, and I have them be judges, where they actually have to look at the flow on the board, clear out all their preconceived biases and notions, and just circle the arguments that they think are as strong and actually stand throughout the debate. And then by the end, they have to justify their decisions using only the flow, not their personal opinions or the popularity contest. So aside from all of this, once the debate is over, that's actually the most important part. That's where you have real learning, not just us versus them thinking, because you actually need to pause and have a real talk conversation, is what I like to say. So I ask students questions like this. What happened in the debate? How did it feel? What do we wish we had done to get our point across? Have we changed our minds about anything? And this is where I have students think about how you would take what you were learning in a debate and apply it to advocate for something in the world. So we drop our debate hats and we think about advocacy. And so, for example, with the topic age is important, we might talk about how we would create a world where age didn't matter at all. So that's pretty exciting, I think. Now, it's really tempting to think that we don't have time for this, and I like to think about all the do-nows that I have and start to weave in little debate skill warm-ups in place of those do-nows, because they really don't take very long, even just teaching argument structure. And then I look at anywhere where I would have a discussion and reframe it as a debate. As educators, we do have an obligation to create spaces to practice debate, because oftentimes there's not going to be any other opportunity for students to do so. And often in competitive debate, it's still, in 2024, is mostly private schools with homogenous student populations, even with significant movements to diversify the activity. But students from systemically marginalized backgrounds, which is all of the students we work with, have even more to gain with debate, because it teaches them to own their voice and advocate for themselves and stand up to challenges that they're going to face in our inequitable world. And so when we think about that with how we're helping students, we actually need to be able to provide them those opportunities to test out their voices and be able to see what happens. And when we do so, we're helping them make choices for themselves. Because what we don't want is for students to choose silence by default. We don't want students to just start labeling people. And we don't want them to be oppressed. We don't want them to be victim to silencing. So another thing, though, that's really important in all of this is to prepare students for the world and the reality that they're going to face. And when I think about that, we think about times when we ask ourselves, is this a productive debate? And sometimes the answer is no. And when we feel unsafe, it's so important to give ourselves the permission to be able to walk away. We need to be able to have a moment where we actually are taking our own power back. And we're able to actually make that choice ourselves. Because sometimes there are people in the world that you just can't argue with. Or the situation or the scenario doesn't really lend itself to that. And so what we want, though, is not to just walk away because we're scared. We want to make a conscious choice to be able to walk away on our own terms because the conditions aren't there. We want to be able to help students recognize when they can make that choice because they know what good debate looks like. Because they've experienced it in your classroom. And so when I think about debate and equity, I also think about telling students, like I always do, that you want to be 60% ready. 100% ready sets up unreasonable expectations for perfection, and you're not adapting to the situation in front of you. And instead, 60% ready gives you permission to try and sometimes fail. The wonderful thing about doing debate a lot, which is what happens in competition, is that you will inevitably fail. In high school, I failed for 2 years before I actually got any good at debate, and I cried all the time, but I still had people who would be there to support me and still love me. But often in the world and in life, it's hard to do debate a lot. There aren't a lot of places like that. And so it's really important to start that process in the classroom so that you can be that guiding force to help them make a choice on their own terms, but also contribute to healing our divides as a society because they know how to have a debate and they know how to have a conversation. And that's the kind of world we want. So I'm going to end before Q&A with a quote from one of our 16-year-old students, Jacob, who was featured in our book, Amplify Student Voices, which has more resources and a chapter all on debate in order to really dig into this. And there's some copies, I think, left in the bookstore and online. So debate introduces you to new perspectives, he says. The opinions of children, in my experience, tend to be almost always the same as their parents or are strongly motivated by society. By researching and discussing both sides, you as the debater are now able to come to your own conclusion. Even when I don't win the round, actually when I don't win, I learn so much about the topic that I haven't really ever thought of. It can truly alter a student's perspectives, challenging their assumptions about society, providing them with tools they can use to form opinions on other topics. Debate is truly, truly life-changing. So thank you for listening. I'm open for questions, and I'm excited to hear your thoughts.
I work at an elementary school. First of all, my daughter's in debate, and it's my daughter's in debate, and it's really transformed her confidence because she's a shy person,
She's not one to always take up space. So it's been great for her. I wonder if what your opinion is on when we can get started. Our debate program is only for fifth and sixth, but I just feel like, okay, there's things you can do in every grade level. What would be your advice on that?
Yeah, so we actually have programs at the practice space, direct service after school programs starting in kindergarten. Kindergarten debate is very funny, but it's also very important. They're so honest. And so it's really about switching up the format. And so from kindergarten through second grade, we usually are doing kind of more of a Q&A. What do you think about this? Here we go. What do you think about this? So it's kind of like a little panel. And then when we reach third grade, that's when we really see that students can start structuring their arguments. And so we do a lot of Congress debate, which is a whole class style of debate where students get to come up with their own bills. And then they argue, they get to choose their side for or against, and they have different questions. So it's a pretty easy format. And the way you win is by participating a lot. So it kind of encourages that mindset. And they can write their own bills. And so students have done bills about climate change, but they also, I think my favorite was one about how to punish porch pirates from stealing your UPS packages. So it can be really fun because you're bringing in student choice into the classroom. And then starting in, like you said, fifth and sixth grade, that's when we start really going into the more competitive debate formats. But that's 10 or 11 years old. And then you just keep on ramping up the timing of the speed. It's really, I started off my career as a special education teacher, and when I applied debate in my classroom, I often found that it was just about lengthening the preparation time and giving them partners or groups to prep with to offer that extra support. I'm glad your daughter's in debate, though.
I have a little bit of the opposite question. Can you speak a little bit on your experience with older folks new to debate and respecting differences of opinions and just following that process, I guess, at the practice space? I'd love to hear.
Yes. Most of the people who come to the practice space, it's not by design, but actually most of the people we work with are women and women leaders. And we have classes for, debate for adults and things like that. And often what we start off with is actually a lot of healing work because so many people have had experiences feeling like an imposter, that their opinions didn't matter. I'm not qualified to speak on that. I didn't study that. Everyone else has more of an opinion than me. So we disrupt that. And we also reflect and process it. And then after that, it's really about, again, it's the topics. The topics matter a lot. It's so tempting to argue personal examples of things, but that's where people are really locked in to their ideas. Even in our political system too, arguing one candidate versus another, it isn't as productive as a debate. It's about actually instead backing up and removing all of those labels that people are already attached to and kind of zeroing in on an issue. And that's even more important with adults than it is with students because they have more years of being latched in. And then we just do the same thing. We do a lot of kind of back and forth, and then we talk a lot about how to apply this to life. Because in life, you don't have that back and forth. And even for me, as an experienced debater, I struggle in life when debates just come out of nowhere, and then you're trying to wrestle with speaking on the spot, but maybe you don't know as much about a topic and you want to go away and research it first. And I teach people to pause and take a moment and say I would love to hear your views and ask questions, but we're going to table that conversation and then revisit it if possible. That gives you that prep time.
Hi, so I'm a special educator and also the parent of a child with autism. And I'm just wondering, what are some strategies you use to support children with communication differences in accessing debate? And then kind of in a second part of question, have you seen any benefits for kids learning to listen better, to give more space to their peers who might communicate differently?
Yes, absolutely. Not a shameless plug, but my first book was called Unlearning Disability, and I studied students who had invisible disabilities, learning disabilities, autism, and followed them for 2 years across different contexts to track how they viewed themselves and how they saw themselves as smart or not smart in some settings versus others. And debate was actually one of the most powerful settings, because for students with autism, and there are a lot in the debate world, it's so comforting to have that structure. And you know when you can speak and when other people are supposed to listen, and you can follow that along the way. And they end up excelling because you know what the social rules are. And it also helps their peers listen to them, and it helps you kind of apply your expertise in a way where actually in my studies, students' disability labels became a lot less relevant, because it was them being able to give power to their own opinions and voice.
One more question. I work with sort of a different style of debate. It's called measureless style. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we focus on is identifying people's interests rather than their positions, because positions can just be you get kind of stuck in them, and you defend them and you polarize, kind of like you were describing earlier. And so if by focusing on interests, you really get to sort of the underlying what's informing, which can be culture, it can be even invisible things. And I'm just curious, like, what your reaction is to that, and how you see, because I'm hearing you talk about a lot of things in the same way that I do. So I'm just curious what your reaction is to that.
Yes. So our theory, and this is what's in Amplify Student Voices, is that if we want to diversify the conversation, we have to have diverse forms of expression. And it all has to be driven by student voice. So I just talked about debate today, because that was the topic for today. But I think leading off first with storytelling, talking about your own experiences, having a discussion, or even weaving in things like poetry or informative presentations where you're talking about your interests. And then as a teacher, you're gathering all that data about all the things your students are listening to, and you can start crafting all those debate topics to then infuse more student interest and therefore increase student engagement, which is something that we found. So I always, even if I only have like 5 minutes, I get lots of student ideas and interests on the board, ask them to talk about what interest them about it, and then I scurry away and I design all of these little debate prompts that then kind of take it further, so you're not just attached to your interests, you're making new ones. Thank you. So please, I thank you so much for coming to the session, and I would love to stay in touch, so I have business cards over here if you'd like to stay in touch, but thank you, and have a good rest of the morning.